from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Let's say you're wandering down the shopping aisle and you pick up a product that's labeled eco-friendly or biodegradable. What does that really mean? Eco-friendly in what way? Biodegradable in how long? Right now, so-called green labeling isn't very specific or very helpful to green-oriented consumers. The FTC is developing new guidelines for green labeling, and in our second hour of forum today, we're going to take a look at what the FTC is proposing and whether it will make a difference to consumers and to the environment. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Last night, I did a little investigative reporting. I went to my local supermarket to check out how various products were labeled, and here's some of what I saw. Just about everything, from laundry detergent to shampoo, is biodegradable. Left unsaid is how long that biodegradable process might take. You can find lots of products that are labeled natural, including a cleaning spray that is 97% naturally derived. And here was my favorite find, an artificial fire log that is 100% renewable, which is an interesting feat if you think about it. Product labeling has definitely gone green, but what the labels actually mean is less clear. For the past year, the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, has been developing new green guidelines. And in this hour forum, we want to talk about those new guidelines and how they ought to provide additional information for environmentally oriented shoppers. We begin our conversation with Jim Kamm, who is director of the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Enforcement. Mr. Kamm, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us as well is Dr. Urvashi Raingun. She's the director of the Technical Policy Unit of the Consumers Union and the project director of Consumer Reports GreenerChoices.org. Dr. Raingun, thanks for being with us as well.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Well, let's start out our conversation with what I just experienced wandering around my grocery store last night, Jim Kamm. It's fascinating because you see all of these labels, but it's not entirely clear what they mean because you just see phrases like natural or biodegradable or compostable or whatever. Is your effort essentially about trying to bring a little more specificity to what those generalized terms mean?
Give you too much of a lawyer answer, but the answer is yes and no. The FTC does not define terms. Terms are defined by consumers. And what marketers are responsible for is being able to substantiate the reasonable meaning, the meaning that a reasonable consumer will take away from a particular term. So what we do through testing and through public comment is try to glean what those meanings are and then within the framework of the law, tell marketers how best to sell their products non-deceptively.
So what does that mean with a term like biodegradable, which is one of the most common terms you see on all kinds of products?
Well, that's a very good example because we have quite a bit of data on what the term biodegradable means to consumers. And basically, it means three things. It means that the product will break down into the elements found in nature, that it will do so within a year, and it will do so after customary disposal.
Well, that's actually quite specific. I mean, so would this then mean that someone who wants to put biodegradable on their label, they have to have given you proof, or it has to be provable that that particular product will break down in a year?
It has to be provable. And let me give you an example. We recently sued Kmart for a paper plate they were selling that they labeled as biodegradable. They had some scientific evidence that, in fact, the paper plate would biodegrade and that in fact, it would biodegrade within 1 year. However, almost all solid waste in the United States is customarily disposed of in the trash, and most of the trash goes to landfills. Well, the three things that any seventh grade science student knows that you need for biodegradation are light, air, and water. And the three things that you can't have by law in American landfills are light, air, and water. so that they won't break down when you throw them in the trash. And so we brought suit against them for making deceptive claims.
Dr. Avashi Rangan at the Technical Policy Unit of the Consumers Union, does this sound like things are moving in the right direction to you?
Well, we've certainly felt very strongly about FTC's involvement in this area. And just so it's clear for your listeners, this isn't the first round of guidance that the FTC's provided. This is really a revision of guidance that they previously provided the marketplace. One thing we really liked about the previous marketing guides was highlighting examples of vague and meaningless claims, things like environmentally friendly, earth smart. And we dare say, as a result, we tended to not see those claims quite as much on the market as some of these other vague and misleading terms. Since those guides were published, however, the market's really mushroomed with more and more green claims everywhere, and it's really become very impossible for consumers to figure out which ones are meaningful and which ones aren't. But we're very supportive of this role that the FTC plays. We think they even need to take a stronger role, actually, and help other agencies who sort of have a toe in the water or even a foot in the door regarding oversight of certain label claims, like natural, for example, and to really help those agencies either ban certain terms that really don't have a lot of meaning or to be able to help them put the teeth behind what they ought to mean as well.
Well, let's take an example from my little shopping excursion last night and help me understand something. When I saw a bottle of cleaning spray that read 97% naturally derived, what would that, I mean, what, I don't know what that means, first of all, but how would you, should you be able to prove that, Jim Com? How would you take a claim like that?
Well, you have to be able to prove two things. You have to be able to prove the express claim and any reasonably implied claims from the express claim. In that instance, I haven't seen that particular example before, and I, quite frankly, I don't know what naturally derived means, much less its implied claim. But the problem with a lot of these terms are what's implied. And that marketer would have to have substantiation not only that it's naturally derived, but any implication from that claim.
Jim Com is the Associate Director of the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Enforcement. He joins us along with Dr. Avashi Rangan, who is the Director of the Technical Policy Unit for the Consumers Union and Project Director of Consumer Reports GreenerChoices.org. Let's take another couple of examples, and then we're going to bring in a couple of other guests to walk us through this, too, just because I'm curious. I got curious walking around the grocery store last night. And that's this question of renewables, what it means when you say something that's made with renewable materials. I was joking, Jim Com, about the fire logs I found that said they were 100% renewable, which made it seem to me like these fire logs were going to be able to reconstitute themselves since they were 100% renewable.
Right.
But what does that mean, or what should it mean as you go forward with more specific definitions of that term?
Well, that's another term that we've tested. First, let me say that I don't see any possibility of a log that you would burn being renewable. The interesting piece here is when we studied the term, it seemed that consumers had a takeaway that was different than the intent of the marketers. So marketers were intending, we think, to make a claim about a material that's replenished at a rate that's as fast or faster than it's used. Consumers took away a recycled claim and a recyclability claim. We didn't think it was reasonable to tell marketers to say this isn't recycled because we thought that would confuse people. But the advice we've given is that if you make a renewable materials claim, you need to say why it's renewable. So, for example, if you had flooring that was made from bamboo, you might say renewable flooring made from fast-growing bamboo.
So renewable, I see. So it's that the product itself is made from something that is a sustainable product or that can be regrown or grown once again? Is that what it means?
Well, that is replenished at a rate as greater than the rate at which it's used. So, for example, you know, you can regrow redwood forests, but it would take a very long time.
Yeah.
And you would use them much faster than you would regrow them. In the case of something like bamboo that can be grown very rapidly, it very well may be the case that you can replenish the supply at the same rate you're using it.
Urvashi Rangan, I mean, this is a fascinating kind of distinction because you could be technically accurate and say a redwood product is renewable, but as Jim Kahn points out, it's a really long renewable process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the whole point about adding specificity, because what one manufacturer may mean by renewable may not be what another manufacturer means by that. And that's some of the trouble with these voluntary claims on the market, is that they're subject to individual company interpretation. And a good rule of thumb for any label that you're looking at on the package is to look for that kind of specific information. If you can't quite understand the claim, then chances are you need to look for more specific information to figure out exactly what it means. I just wanted to go back for a minute to the naturally derived cleaning product, because I think cleaning products are also a whole product category where ingredients are not required to be disclosed on the package, and that's not like food, and even the personal care product sector discloses most of the ingredients that are used. And that's really problematic because it's virtually impossible for you, the consumer, to verify whether it is truly all naturally derived. And people should also make a mental note that just because something is derived from a natural ingredient, it doesn't mean it was natural the whole way through. A great example, and the FTC's done some enforcement against this, is bamboo that is synthetically processed into rayon. And although the rayon came from a renewable material that was bamboo, it is not bamboo, and it isn't a natural material either. And so at the end of the day, it's something that is really what we would consider to be synthetic. So all to say, the more specific you can find on the package, the more specific information, the better.
Dr. Urvashi Rangan, who is the Director of Technical Policy for the Consumers Union. Let's bring in a couple of other voices into our conversation and focus in a little bit more on this whole question of that consumers might understand these terms differently than what marketers intend. So let's hear from Jackie Ottman. She is the author of a book called The New Rules of Green Marketing. She's a consultant to various Fortune 500 companies and the United States government on green marketing issues, her company, J. Altman Consulting. Jackie Ottman, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here, Dave.
So let's talk a little bit more about this consumer question, because both Urvashi Rangan and Jim Kahn are making the point that consumers may understand terms that are put out there differently than marketers might. And what's occurring to me as we go through this conversation, that this is pretty complicated stuff, and it's expecting consumers in some ways to, you know, be really reading labels carefully and be doing a kind of level of homework that I'm not sure most people want to engage in when they're going out to do their weekend shopping. So what can you tell us about that, about what consumers sort of process and what the need is perhaps for consumers to do homework that they might not otherwise necessarily be inclined to do?
Sure. And it may be a question of not necessarily the consumer doing homework, but information, additional information, excuse me, that's provided by the manufacturers and the marketers. For example, one concern that I have about the FTC guides is the potential confusion that can result when claims disclose the percentage of ingredients like recycled or bio-based. And I'm a consultant to the USDA's bio-based program, so I'm very familiar with this issue from a bio-based standpoint. But if we just look at recycled, something that everyone is familiar with, the FTC guidelines require that you disclose the percentage of recycled content. And I understand that need for transparency. You don't want a product with 1% recycled content making a broad claim like made with recycled content. But there's a downside to this, which is that we are now training consumers to think that more is better when we disclose those that percentage of ingredients. And more is better might not necessarily, more may not necessarily better. So, for example, in some instances, 30% recycled content paper may actually be environmentally preferable to 100%. It all depends, for example, on how far you have to transport those recyclables to the factory where you're making the paper or what have you. Now, the specific concern that we have with USDA-certified bio-based is that the program, and this is a brand new label for anyone out there who hasn't heard about it, is allowing businesses to make claims based upon designated levels designated by the USDA based on performance. So a lip balm might only be required to have 11% certified bio-based ingredients, but that number doesn't look so impressive to consumers. Same thing with Coke has a plant bottle now, 30% recycled plastic. Well, that doesn't look as good to consumers versus, let's say, 100% PLA from NatureWorks, for example. And it may be that the Coke bottle is actually preferable to 100% of another kind of a material.
Let me get Urvashi Rangan to come back on that point. Do you concur that sort of percentages are not necessarily the best barometer?
I think I disagree a little bit with Jackie. I see your point, Jackie, in that when you look at the whole life cycle of a product and you're integrating a lot of other factors, it may be that the overall environmental friendliness or the importance of the product may be skewed by those numbers, and that you can have something that's very, very made out of a lot of recycled content, but it came from China, and so it was transported around the globe to get there, and therefore it took up a lot of energy to do that, probably more than the recycled material versus using a virgin material itself. So I can appreciate that concern. I think, however, if we're talking about these really specific claims like recycled content, we think percentages are important, because if somebody is especially going to pay more for that product, then it needs to meet their expectations with regard to the claim that's being used. And I'd like to talk just a minute about the new bio-based program, because I think it's also a great example of where it starts out trying to do the right thing, and yet old biomaterial like cotton and wool are completely exempt from the bio-based program. So you can have a carpet that's made out of 7% PLA, which is a recycled plastic or biodegradable plastic, and that can be labeled bio-based, but if you have an organic wool rug, that is not eligible for the bio-based label. So I think that it's a more complicated matter than that when it comes to bio-based, but I think when you're using discrete claims, knowing how much of that discrete claim is being used in the product is still important for consumers.
You know, it's interesting, Urvashi Rangan, you used the word complicated, and I have to say that's what I'm thinking about as we're going through this, and I suspect some of our listeners as well, that this is complicated, and when we go shopping, we don't want necessarily things to be complicated. So, Jim Kamm, I mean, help us through what you're trying to achieve through the FTC. Is it important that these be as simple and clear and concise as possible, so that we don't sort of scratch our heads every time we want to buy something?
Well, it's important to see where the FTC is coming from, and we have a little different perspective on this. It doesn't really matter what the marketer intends. What's important to us is that the consumer isn't deceived.
Yeah.
And whether the claim is simple or complicated, that the marketer be able to substantiate all the reasonably implied and expressed claims from whatever they're saying. And so that's what we're looking at. So from our perspective, we aren't an environmental policy agency. We're agnostic about whether things are environmentally friendly or not. What we want to do is make sure that consumers' expectations are met. So if you look at the percentages of recycled material, it in one context, the consumer may care about how much recycled content there is. That may be their primary concern. If there's no implication in the marketing that there's a greater environmental impact, and it's important for them to know that, not to be deceived. We did ask a question in our green guides about these very trade-offs that you were talking about transportation and so forth, if there's an implied claim in general environmentally friendly product, and we're struggling with how marketers should communicate that.
Jim Kamm, again, Associate Director of the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Enforcement. I want to give out our phone number and email address because we'd really like to hear your point of view as consumers in all of this. What kind of information would be helpful to you as you go shopping? What kind of labels would be important to make informed decisions? What have you come up against in the past that you found perhaps misleading or concerning? 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. forum@kqed.org. Let's bring in, before we go to our break in a few minutes, I just want to bring in one more voice, and then all of you can stay with us, hopefully, for as long as possible in the second part of our program. Martin Wolf is Product Director in Research and Development for Seventh Generation, which makes a variety of household products, also laundry, detergent and soaps, baby care products, personal care products, and extensively markets those products for their environmental qualities. Martin Wolf, thanks for joining us as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
So let's get a quick example out from you, and based on the kind of conversation we've been having, so we can get a keener sense of what that means. I looked on your website this morning, and one of your laundry detergents carries the label "free of chemical brighteners." So, what is it? Does that mean briefly, if you would please, and why is that important for a consumer to know that something is free of chemical brighteners? And I'm sorry, I'm just going to give you a minute and a half or so on this because then we're going to our break. But just get us started on that sort of topic, if you would.
I'll do my best. Chemical brighteners are an ingredient added to conventional laundry detergents that makes them glow when they are struck by ultraviolet light. So if you go into a disco that has black lights, you may see people's shirts shining because the black lights in the disco activate these optical brighteners. We don't believe that is adding to the cleanliness of the shirt. In fact, it's leaving a residue on the shirt that a consumer, A, is probably not aware of, and B, may not want to have on their clothing. So we sell products that are called free and clear. We don't have fragrances or dyes or optical brighteners in those products because we don't think they're necessary to perform the job of the laundry detergent. So I hope that's the clarification you're looking for.
No, that's very useful, and you did that in like 30 seconds, so that was terrific. So Jim Kamm, because I think we have to leave you. You have to leave us shortly. If you can stay, that'd be terrific. But what would you be looking for in that label when it says free of chemical brighteners? What's the test that you want to put that to?
Well, the first thing we look at is what is that communicating? There's an express claim that says it doesn't have a chemical brightener, and that if that's the only claim and it does not have any such brightener, then that's fine and that's the end of the inquiry. The question is whether it conveys something greater than that to consumers, that there was a broader environmentally friendly claim. On its face, I have to say, it doesn't seem like there's a broader claim, but the way we would determine something like that would be to copy test the ad or the packaging.
And we'll come back and talk more about the variety of claims that products make and what would be useful for consumers to know about those particular claims when we return. Again, here's our number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Green labeling is our topic this hour. The FTC is currently putting together a new green guide on what those green labels actually mean, trying to make certain terms more specific so that consumers, when they go to the market, can know what a term like biodegradable actually means. We're joined this hour by Jim Kamm, who's Associate Director of the FTC's Division of Enforcement, Martin Wolf, who is the Project Director in Research and Development, Product Director, rather, in Research research and development for Seventh Generation, which makes a variety of household products. Jackie Ottman, who runs Ottman Consulting and consults on these issues, and Urvashi Rangan, who is the Director of Technical Policy for the Consumers Union. I want to get out just one more Seventh Generation example, and thanks for being sort of our guinea pig on this, Martin Wolf, and then I want to take in our phone calls. One of the other products I saw of yours was a dishwasher liquid that said now contains enzymes, which I suppose is a good thing, but why is that on the label?
The dishwasher liquid that you're referring to is a new product, and our prior product, and in fact most dishwasher liquids, do not contain enzymes. Enzymes are very important cleaning agents, and we felt that their presence was important because they greatly enhance the efficacy of that product. So that is why that's on the label. I don't see that as so much an environmental claim as a performance claim, though.
I see. Okay. And Jim Kamm at the FTC, this is one of those things that has an implied benefit. If I see something that says now contains enzymes, as a consumer, I'm supposed to think that's a good thing. And it probably is a good thing. I don't mean to doubt it. Mm-hmm. But how do you deal with something that's implicit like that?
Well, that performance claims like green claims have to be substantiated, and anything that a reasonable consumer would imply, and I think what a reasonable consumer would imply from that, is that the dishwasher liquid is more effective because it has enzymes, has to be substantiated. So presumably Seventh Generation has substantiation that shows that their product's performance was improved for that reason, and then they're fine.
And let's hear what our listeners are wondering about this topic this morning. We're joined first by Ryan from Richmond. Ryan, go ahead, please.
So, you know, one thing that I see a lot is, you know, cars that say they're environmentally friendly or fuel efficient. And I'm not necessarily making a claim to this, but, you know, a Prius does all these wonderful things. It's got solar panels and, you know, generating brakes for more power. And I'm wondering, you know, some people lay claim that processing the nickel in China and transporting it to Canada to be processed more and then to the U.S. to be sold is more labor-intensive than what the car ends up producing in 10 years of the battery cycle. So I'm not necessarily saying it's not efficient, but some of those things don't necessarily show you the exact trade-off between how much it costs to manufacture environmentally and what the total payoff is for owning that vehicle for that time frame.
Yeah, Ryan, thanks. Interesting point. Is that something you have to assess, Jim Kamm, or does this get out of your territory?
No, this is exactly in our territory, and it's one of the pieces of advice we gave is not to make general environmental claims that are unqualified in any context. So if you were to say that a car were environmentally friendly, that would almost certainly be deceptive because the takeaway is so broad, and in fact, more than a quarter of the population would take away a claim that it had no environmental impact whatsoever. That's why we encourage specific claims. In that case, in the case that the caller postulated, that the energy efficiency claims, if they can be proved, would be fine. The question is, does it imply a broader claim? And the chances are, in that circumstance, it does not. But you would need to test the ad to know for sure.
Urvashi Rangan, is this part of why, again, it's complicated because we need kind of multiple measures? In other words, if, I don't know, a particular, let's say a dishwasher uses less energy but consumes more water, then there's a trade-off involved. In other words, do we need things that sort of lay out for us all of those different measurements so you can make a kind of collective assessment?
Well, I think your question's a really good one, and it's more about a production system within any product category and understanding all of the inputs and outputs to that system. Whether that whole process can be captured on a label, I think, is in question. Walmart is certainly trying to go that direction. They're trying to develop a large sustainability label. You know, we will be watching that. We feel that there are so many problems with discrete claims on the market and making sure that those are truthful that it's it's going to be difficult to provide these huge conglomerate labels to see if they're truthful as well. And how does a consumer know when the bottom's sort of falling out of one or two of the criteria when there's a whole conglomerate label that's using it? We think discrete labels are the most helpful to consumers, and we think they're better able to be substantiated. And I guess just to take one step back from all of this, we're talking with the FTC and their role in green marketing. And I think in our minds, that's really talking about the floor. What's the level playing field out there for the marketplace? But it shouldn't take away from the fact that there is also a ceiling to this, and there are credible labels that are independent from the products that are being certified, that have a verification component to them, that are also out there as well, and are, frankly, we think, more reliable in many ways than these voluntary claims, where we're trying to make sure that at least there's a level playing field for all of them.
And let's take another listener call, Elise in Burlingame. Elise?
Yes, my question is exactly on point with what you all are talking about. Why not have a national rating system that, like, similar to one that was just recently announced in an op-ed piece in the New York Times that's being driven by the industry and that makes clothes? They're getting together and saying, where does the clothes come from? What percentage is organic? How does it get to market?
Yeah.
What's the impact on the environment? Is there any kind of effort like that? You mentioned something having to do with Walmart. How about not just a Walmart label, but how about an industry rating system that is either led by the government, or if the government won't set up, by the industry itself? Clearly, there's a need and an interest for it.
Great question. Thanks, Elise, for adding that in. It reminds me a bit of what you can do now in terms of your fish shopping. If you want to buy a sustainable fish, the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California puts out a little guide that many people, including me, carry in your wallet. And then if you're at the store, you can pull it out and say, okay, is tilapia what I ought to buy or not? Wouldn't that make sense, Jackie Ottman, from both an industry standpoint and a consumer standpoint, to have something that's sort of ready-made like that?
Sure. Information is always helpful. However, I believe there's a limit to the extent that you can simplify this information.
Mm-hmm.
For example, and this is maybe even too broad, but the decision whether I should use cloth or disposable diapers for my baby, it may be that cloth is better for those of us here on the East Coast in New York City who have water but no landfill, and the disposable might be better, actually the environmentally preferable alternative in the Southwest, where you could create more environmental problems if you tried to bring in the water to wash the diapers. So at some point, we really need to give the consumer information that they can make the choices that are right for them.
Yeah, really interesting point. Howard in Larkspur, go ahead with your observation. Howard?
Yes, I've been in the restaurant business my entire life, and springboarding off of what you just commented on, is restaurants are the largest, most numerous business in the world. Second largest users of gas, electricity, water, not to mention all the consumable and non-consumable products they use, such as seafood. And the challenge is how does the public identify a restaurant that is actually doing practicing sustainable business and embracing those kind of practices? You know, the Seafood Watch is a good start, but it's not... It certainly doesn't cover all the moving parts that a restaurant has.
Howard, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Urvashi Rankin, you want to weigh in on his comment?
Well, I think Howard's got a really good question, and shouldn't restaurants also sort of be evaluated on some level if that's part of their marketing as well, to be a more sustainable restaurant that has a higher consciousness for different environmental attributes? So we haven't rated them, but I believe there is movement afoot to do some sort of green restaurant certification. And I'm sorry, I wish I had the actual information on me. I'm going to see if I can get it while I'm here. But it is called the Green Restaurant Association, and there are certification standards, and that's definitely something that Howard should explore.
Here's a really interesting question emailed into us from Sarah, and it's an important topic we haven't gotten to yet, and it has to do with certification. Sarah writes in, what about Green America certification and fair trade? What do these mean for environmental claims and concerns? Jim Kamm at the FTC, that's one of the things you're looking at, that certifications actually have to mean something. You took SC Johnson to task for their Windex and Shout products, which carried a Green List label, but it turns out that Green List label was something that was provided by SC Johnson. So what are you trying to do to make certifications matter and be more clear?
Well, certifications are a double-edged sword. They're, as one of the guests already commented, they can be extremely valuable when you have a third-party certifier who's sorting out these very complex claims for consumers. What we've said in that areas, you need to make sure that you're disclosing any hidden connections. So that we need to know, are you self-certifying? Is it an industry certification? Who's creating the standards and who's applying the standards so that consumers can reasonably evaluate the strength of the certification? That's our primary concern in that area. However, there's another concern that the certification not make a general claim. So for example, if I have Jim's Green certification, what does that mean? Does that mean my product's biodegradable? Does it mean it's recyclable? What does it have in it that's environmentally friendly? So we want to make sure that the material connections are disclosed and that the claim that's being made can be substantiated.
Here's an email from Rick that maybe you can respond to, Martin Wolf. I'd like to know why there are so many people in our ecologically concerned area that use horrifically perfumed fabric softeners like Bounce and Downy and so many others. They have such a strong fragrance that I think sometimes I'd fall down walking by. I guess I wanted to read that in part because I don't know, honestly, if you do this or not, but it wouldn't surprise me if Seventh Generation makes products that are perfume-free. What's the point in that? And again, what's the sort of implicit value of adding that in?
Okay, I would like to contribute to the prior discussion as well as answer
sure,
the question
sure.
you've just asked. We look at certifications as a floor, not as a ceiling. Once you've achieved a certain level of compliance in your product begins to look like other products that can carry the seal. So we see a limitation to certifications, the fact that a product that has attributes beyond the certification becomes comparable to the product that only meets the certification. And that's one reason we've been concerned about using certifications on our label, because we have very high standards. We do publish them on our website, and we feel that people should not look at our product and a second product and think they're comparable when they're not. And what certifications need to do is find a way to recognize not only that companies that stand on the floor, but have also reached for the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most consumer product companies believe that consumers want fragrance in their products, and they want to transfer those fragrances to clothing, surfaces, the air of the house, etc. Seventh Generation certainly recognizes that there are consumers who seek that benefit, but there are risks associated with that benefit. Not all chemicals used in fragrances are without hazard. That is, all of the ingredients or many of the ingredients have associated hazards, and you're putting them in the air, which you breathe and therefore are exposed to. Seventh Generation, therefore, uses only natural plant oils to fragrance some of its products, and it has lines of fragrance-free products so that you can avoid the entire issue of hazard from these fragranced materials. One very important part of this is that we disclose ingredients on our labels, including the components of the fragrances we use. So we'll say we use lavender oil where we use lavender oil, or bergamot oil where we use bergamot oil. because there are people who have sensitivities to those oils, and they should know what's there. Most companies do not reveal their fragrance components. They only say fragrance on the label, and therefore you don't know what's in it. And particularly since there are synthetic chemicals that have either an undefined risk or a known risk associated with them, we think companies should, in fact, disclose exactly what components are in their fragrances so consumers can assess that risk.
Martin Wolf, again, the product director in research and development for Seventh Generation. Some really interesting emails coming in that let's see if we can work our way through a couple of these in short order. Mary writes in, I'd love to have a PDA app that lets you scan barcodes on products and then present you with distilled information. It's a really interesting idea. You're working on anything like that at Consumers Union or Vashi Rangan?
We are actually contemplating something similar to that. It wouldn't be necessarily a barcode scan, but certainly a label app where you could figure out what exactly the labels mean that you're seeing, what level of verification is behind them, what, if any, standards are behind them as well, and I think that's really important. I'll also maybe throw up, there is another website called goodguide.org, and that's another good first swat through. It puts all the different products in there. It's a database that basically is a making of hundreds of databases. So it's not their information per se, and it's subject to, you know, potential update perps. But it is a good first swat through.
You want to give that again, please?
That's goodguide.org.
Good guide.
Good guide. Dot org.
Okay, goodguide.org. Thanks.
Yeah.
Here's a great question from Elizabeth, who writes, I spent a lot of money buying biodegradable dog waste bags, believing them to be better for the environment than plastic bags because they biodegrade. I thought I heard your guest say that biodegradable means nothing if the landfill is closed to sun, air, etc. So in that case, am I wasting my money using biodegradable bags versus plastic bags? Great question. Jim Com?
If you're throwing those bags away in the garbage, the answer is yes. That if you throw them away in the garbage, they're going to go into landfill, most likely. Not all trash goes to landfill, but that's where it most likely goes, and it won't biodegrade. Now, there may be places, for example, commercial composting facilities, that if those facilities are available to you, you could take them there and the bags would biodegrade.
Here's a question from Andy. I try to buy locally, and I recently brought hand lotion that had Sonoma Valley in the name. On getting a home, I noticed that it was made in Canada for a New Mexico firm. The bottle said, made from ingredients that call Sonoma home. Jim Com, that seems pretty misleading.
Well, it depends what the takeaway is from that. That if you get ingredients from Sonoma, from California, then it's not misleading on its face. The question is whether there's an implied claim there. Quite frankly, it sounds to a large degree like puffing. However, if you're selling it in Sonoma and saying that these are local ingredients and people think because it's local you're using less energy, then that's a real problem.
Jackie Ottman, you want to sound off on that point as well, please?
Sure. Actually, if I could, I'd like to make a point that I can speak more strongly on, which is the biodegradable.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I've been doing this 23 years, and I kind of see these issues just repeating year after year. The biodegradable issue is not new. Hefty made biodegradability claims 20 years ago that were taken to court and they were sued in seven states, et cetera. So I think what this points to is the need to make sure that the FTC green guides are publicized and understood and, you know, with real outreach into the industry and also guidance for consumers so that they know when they see a biodegradable claim, they know that it might be specious.
And to John in Madison, Georgia. John, go ahead.
This me?
Yes, you're on.
Yes. My question was with this, these things that are using recycled materials. Shouldn't it be cheap? Shouldn't these things be cheaper now because you're using essentially trash that would have been thrown away, so that your raw material cost goes down on these consumer products? You know, it seemed like they should be the ones that are the, you know, great value at Walmart, for example, because they're not using the new virgin materials to make them. So that's
yeah.
my question.
Yeah, interesting. I'm just going to throw this open. I'm not sure who can take that on. Anyone want to try to respond, please, to John's question?
Sure. This is Martin.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jim. You can go first.
There's two pieces of that equation that are missing. First, it's not necessarily cheaper to use recycled materials. It depends on whatever the manufacturing process is. And even if it were cheaper, the market prices prevail. So if people are willing to pay more for that product, then presumably manufacturers are going to charge more, even if it costs them less to make.
And Martin Wolf, did you want to add in something?
I think Jim said exactly what I was going to say. We live in a market economy, and it's interesting to see the cost of these recycled materials float with the price of the overlying virgin commodity. And in addition, there are costs associated with recycling and making a useful product, and it's not always a lower cost. So Jim said it quite well.
All right, let's get to another caller. Danielle joins us, who's driving along in the state of Maine. Danielle, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much for this program. As a person who is in the process of establishing a new sustainability website to help guide people to make these kinds of choices more easily, and also a person with multiple food and chemical sensitivities, I've got a two-layered question, if you don't mind. The first is the FTC or any other federal organization, bureau, taking up the issue that cleaning products do not have to be labeled with their ingredients? Is that in the offing?
Okay. Jim Kamm?
Sorry. I apologize. That would not be the Federal Trade Commission, because we don't have the authority to require that marketers say anything in particular or provide labels outside of some specific congressional authority in the energy area. All we can do is make sure that if they do say something, that it's truthful and substantiated. That would be the EPA, and I'm not really familiar with anything they're doing in that area.
Irvashi Rankin, can you help our caller with anything further?
Yeah,
it sounds like there's no requirement. Go ahead.
Well, there's not, but there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And Jim's right, it is EPA that regulates a number of cleaning products. The Consumer Product Safety Commission also regulates cleaning products. It's sort of split between them. And that's unfortunate, because sometimes when product categories straddle agencies, things fall through the cracks. And again, that's why we think it's so important for FTC to sort of be the gum at times. In this particular case, it is tricky in terms of requiring the label. New York State actually has a very interesting sleeping law on the books. It's been around since 1971. It requires cleaning manufacturers to disclose not only the ingredients, but the safety of those ingredients. And the law was never implemented. It sort of bubbled up for a little while during phosphate labeling issues, and then it sort of went back to sleep. That's something that a number of groups, Earth Justice uncovered it, and groups like ours, as well as a number of others, are fighting for that in New York State to make sure that that law becomes fully implemented, and that could really set an important precedent for the nation.
Martin Wolf, at Seventh Generation, is this something you do even though it's not required? Is there an advantage, in effect, if you are sort of fully transparent about that, whether it's required or not?
We do that. We put every ingredient in a product on the label of that product using the rules that the Food and Drug Association sets for cosmetics. We do it in descending order of predominance, and we go beyond the FDA rules by actually listing what components are in fragrances. The industry has taken a step forward overall. Many companies have agreed to comply with a voluntary ingredient communication standard, and those companies have started websites in which they list the ingredients for their products. So we look at that as a good first step, but We strongly support the efforts by people like Voices of the Earth and Consumers Union to see much stronger rules requiring disclosure. We think companies should be transparent about what they're doing so consumers can make educated choices. We also think companies should be proud of what they put in their products, not wanting to hide it.
And Danielle, we're short on time, but it sounded like you had one more quick thing you wanted to raise. Danielle?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead real briefly, please.
Okay. In the absence of a standard set of information about a product's, say, carbon footprint from birth to death, as you were talking about earlier, you know, factoring in transportation costs and things like that, as well as ingredients, what is the best way for consumers to begin to gather that information at this time, or for someone like myself who wants to provide that information?
Danielle, thanks. Urvashi Rangan, on that and sort of best advice once we go around on that once about where people can kind of get the best comprehensive information for someone like Danielle.
Well, I think Danielle's talking really getting into life cycle, what we call life cycle analysis, and that gets even beyond carbon footprint, but all sorts of things, toxics, energy use, things like that. As I understand it, I mean, this is something that's very complicated. It happens sort of at the academic level, but it seems that there's an agreement that that information ought to be something that's made more public, and I think there is movement afoot to make life cycle assessments more public so that people aren't reinventing the wheel every single time. So I think that's something to watch out for in the marketplace, and it's something that'll be coming.
And Jim Kamm, last quick word on where to point people who want to know the best information they can get?
Well, the information that we give is largely to the marketers. However, you can go to the www.ftc.gov/green, and there's plenty of information about green marketing and the law on that site.
Jim Kamm, Associate Director for the FTC's Division of Enforcement. Wish we had more time. Really interesting subject. Thanks all for participating. Martin Wolf joined us as well from Seventh Generation, Jackie Ottman of J. Ottman Consulting, and Dr. Urvashi Rangan, Director of Technical Policy for the Consumers Union. Thanks all for participating in our program. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And we want to thank our interns, Nathan Falk and Vinny Tong, and a special thanks to Adam Hill and Katrina Schwartz, who wrapped up their internship this summer, as well as our Coro fellow, Alexander Tran. Thanks all for all your help. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.